Chapter 7. And That's a Good Thing. American consumers grumbled about how everything was being made over there, and what they were referring to were the products they saw in retail stores, the toys on the shelves, the clothes on the racks. It rarely occurred to them that even the shelves and the racks were being made in China. Classic Metal was a major manufacturer of store fixtures with revenues exceeding $50 million. When it began losing business to competitors who were more forward-thinking in pursuing cheap outsourcing opportunities, the company set its sights on China. The head of the delegation was a Chicagoan, John, who had already identified three factories that he felt sure were capable of manufacturing the kinds of fixtures that his company designed and fabricated in the United States. He said that his company was looking for some simple, on-the-ground assistance and wanted to know if I could join his team. We agreed to meet in Hong Kong, where I would hand him train tickets that I had purchased in advance. Just 1 week before the delegation's scheduled arrival, John emailed me and said that he had a pressing question. "What kind of gifts should we bring?" he asked when he got me on the phone. The question caught me off guard. Most importers I knew did not bring anything at all. It did not seem to adversely affect their business in any event, but I could appreciate the concern. China was often painted as a mysterious place, and books on doing business in China left many newcomers walking on eggshells. Foreigners were taught to believe that a mispronounced phrase in Chinese could turn a simple sentence into an insult. These mythmakers had many people believing that the slightest misstep would ruin a deal, but it was the furthest thing from the truth. Chinese manufacturers did not care one way or another about gifts. What they cared about were orders. Offerings could not make a bad deal look good. Importers either had orders in hand or they did not. This business of gift-giving would be the least of this client's problems, as we would learn. We met in Hong Kong at a hotel in Tsim Sha Tsui. John came with others, two men from the company's production department and a woman involved in logistics. Once across the border and inside mainland China, we went to a hotel and checked in. The hotel desk manager asked everyone to place their passports on the counter. Only one out of the four had ever been to China before, and their passports looked thin and crisp. My own had pages added to it and was swollen like a paperback left out in the rain, and from years of being jammed into various bags and pockets, the gold-colored bald eagle on the front had faded away. Placed next to theirs, mine had the look of a passport belonging to someone from another country altogether. Since our hotel had no currency exchange service, the four of them asked to borrow some renminbi just until we had a chance to get to a bank. One member of the group, Mike, looked at the red currency notes I gave him and chuckled. "It looks like monopoly money," he said. After promising to pay me back the next day, John reminded me to send him receipts for expenses. The next morning, the group from Chicago arrived in the lobby, and a factory owner, who preferred to be called Miss Lee, met us. We drove into the country, past a number of tiny hamlets. It was an unusual spot for a factory, I thought. When we stopped, I noted that we were not in an industrial area at all, but near some tall grass where scrawny-looking chickens wandered about. Miss Lee went to the side of a brick building. It was not a factory, but a small warehouse. John and his three colleagues walked hesitatingly into the building, surveying it carefully, but there was really nothing there. No one said a word, and I was not quite sure what to think of it myself. Along one wall there were some boxes, and in an opposite corner was a single small sign of industry, one lone metal stamping machine. A few chrome racks had been taken out of the boxes and set up in the middle of the small space. These were by no means custom racks. They were the sort of generic racks you might have found in a thrift shop back in the United States. Everyone from Chicago walked over to the racks and pretended to be interested in them. They had been traveling for more than 2 days, and this was supposed to be the first of three factories on John's list of potential suppliers. They were expecting to see a production process, especially since Miss Lee had indicated that she owned and operated a factory. "What do they think?" Miss Lee asked me, sounding hopeful. John was quiet, as were the others. "It's not exactly a factory," I said. "Please tell them that we can make whatever they want." John looked embarrassed when I explained what she had said. I asked how he had come to learn about Miss Lee, and he admitted that he had found her on a website. China was full of wannabes, and there were many agents who pretended to be manufacturers. John said that he didn't understand. Miss Lee had said that her company manufactured custom store fixtures. "They probably did," I offered, but at some other location. If Miss Lee was not willing to take us to that factory, it meant that her relationship with the actual supplier was a tenuous one at best. In other words, it was a bad sign. Most importers did not want to work with agents. One reason was that agents did not always take their business to the most capable supplier, but instead directed their business to the company that provided the best commission. Often, the supplier might be a friend or a relative, which also posed a problem if there were quality issues. With a bad shipment of product, the agent was more likely to show allegiance to the factory boss than to the importer. At least in this case, we knew that Miss Lee was an agent from the very beginning. Some importers learned only much later, after a background check, or after a product went bad and there was a dispute. It was our first day together, and I was worried for the folks at Classic Metal. Typically, whenever an American company claimed that China was the key to its future success, the chief executive flew out with the group. These four were on their own, and I wondered whether the president of the company would ever learn that his representatives had flown all the way to China only to inspect an empty warehouse. We moved on to our second destination, and while this time there was an actual factory on the premises, the company was manufacturing a kind of exercise machine instead of store fixtures. The factory tour itself was short, and we were led into a showroom. The collection that we were shown included a large number of random yet professional-looking retail fixtures and displays. "This is much better," said John, sounding relieved. Attentions were turned to a copper-colored shelving system with a textured surface. One of the production team ran a finger over the surface. "What kind of finish is this?" he asked. "Yes, no problem," the factory owner replied. He either had not heard the question or chose not to answer it. It did not take long to realize that this factory had not produced most of the samples in the showroom. The factory was too small for such a varied offering, and the company did not seem equipped to pull off some of the items. At the back of the sample room, I noticed a number of shipping boxes that had come in by DHL and FedEx. I glanced at a few of the addresses. They were all from the United States. The showroom products seemed to be samples that came in from American companies. It was possible that they had been samples from prospective customers, or perhaps they belonged to competitors. Some Chinese manufacturers did this sort of thing. They set up an address in the United States and pretended they were a buyer. They then contacted competitors and requested product samples. These were then shipped back to China, where they were placed in a showroom. A factory had to appear skilled to catch customers, and it was too expensive to make a product line before an order actually came in. Manufacturers all suffered from this chicken-and-egg problem. To kickstart their businesses, they had to fool customers into thinking that they were already in motion. The easiest way to do this was by throwing samples, anyone's samples, into a showroom. If pressed for the truth, a factory owner might admit that his factory did not actually produce all of the items that were on display, but there was nothing to stop an importer from jumping to certain conclusions on its own. Chinese factories made plenty of counterfeit products, and so it was no great surprise that they also faked entire showrooms. The purpose of these make-believe displays was to spark the imagination. It was a place for importers to dream, and this is exactly what the representatives from Classic Metal did. They oohed and aahed, and while they did so, the factory owner stood by silently and looked hopeful. For a new factory looking to get into business, all it took was a single purchase order from a large importer. These suppliers with potential could be awakened by a meaningful client, as if by a magical kiss from a storybook prince. It didn't matter whether the factory had actually ever made any of the products in its showroom, just one purchase order and the factory would work out the rest later. Everyone looked at samples in the showroom, and along with the exercise equipment that was there, someone spotted an air conditioner unit that had been placed on top of one of the many racks. "Look," someone said, "they even make air conditioners." Everyone laughed, but not convincingly. I worried that they actually thought that the appliance had something to do with this factory. The owner had done such a good job of convincing the group from Chicago that anything could be made at his plant, so it really wasn't such a far leap. The third factory was the only one we visited that looked capable, but in the extreme. At the front of the place, two flags were flown, the U.S. flag and the flag of the People's Republic of China, both at the same height. When we pulled in through the gate, a guard saluted, and the factory owner, Stanley, saluted back. They had hundreds of employees located among several large buildings, and they were all dressed in crisp uniforms. The place looked so impressive that if I had not known otherwise, I might have believed they were producing high-tech goods, not metal displays and racks. The showroom was larger than the previous factories, and this time you could believe that they made just about everything that was there. On one side of the massive showroom were display shelves for supermarkets. In another section, there were displays for tennis rackets, athletic shoes, and for other sporting goods. Depending on the angle at which you stood, you could imagine yourself in almost any kind of retail space. The group from Chicago was dumbstruck, and they quickly revised their plans for orders at the previous factory. This one would be the factory that would produce their products, John declared, and he did not need any further convincing. That a China manufacturing operation was efficient was not always the best sign. Quite often, it meant that the factory charged more. In China, economies of scale did not always mean a cheaper price, and more troubling was that the boss of the company, Stanley, seemed even smoother than his operation. He told us how he got started in business. He had once been an agent, just like Miss Lee, and when one of his biggest customers placed a sizable order along with a substantial deposit, he recognized his chance and delayed shipment of the order long enough until he had found a building to rent. He then purchased some equipment and filled the bulk of the order. In his office, Stanley delivered a small speech about all that he was doing for his employees. He had set up a karaoke lounge at the factory, he said, where workers could spend their evenings. He peppered his language with buzzwords like corporate social responsibility and said that he had initiated a profit-sharing plan. When we went onto the factory floor later, I buttonholed a few workers and asked them if they had anything like a profit-sharing scheme in place. Aside from the usual Chinese New Year bonus, the one that most companies gave out, the workers could not name any such arrangement. It may have been the amount of time I had already spent working in other plants, but Stanley came off as disingenuous. My clients perceived him as sincere, though, and as far as they were concerned, he was too good to be true. They remarked in front of him how happy they were with the factory, and without first discussing price, they had all but agreed to send Stanley their orders. There was another problem with this factory, though. Classic Metal's competitors were using the same supplier, and their volume was more substantial. In the warehouse, John noticed the logo of a major competitor on a great number of stacked boxes. Finding a capable supplier was important, but it was problematic to source products from the same place where your competitor got them. It was too difficult to differentiate your company's own offering in the marketplace, and in this one case, there was another issue. Classic Metal's order sizes were going to be smaller than their competitors, which meant less buying power. In an open bidding process, they would probably lose bids to their competition, and even if they did catch orders, they would have a harder time catching the factory's attention, which meant the possibility of quality failures. When the group saw the product belonging to their competitor, hearts sank. John understood the flaw in their strategy, but he said there was no real choice. The trip had already been planned, and this was the factory that gave them the most confidence in their manufacturing capability. The more time we spent with Stanley, the more I got concerned about doing business with him. At one point, he had claimed to own the factory outright, but then there was a plaque in his office that suggested the factory was actually a joint venture. The American flag that flew out front was a likely indication of where the partners came from. Stanley also mentioned that he flew to the United States often and belonged to an American industry association. There were other manufacturers that did not have such easy access to the importer's own customer base. How could Classic Metal be sure that Stanley's company would not place bids that were in direct competition? The decision had been made to give Stanley their business, and John suggested that it was time to wrap up the visit. That meeting went fast, he said. And that's a good thing, said one of the others from Chicago. Everyone was in a hurry to get out of the factory. They had shopping on their minds. Before it was time to return to the United States, they wanted to pick up China souvenirs. Everyone had a specific type of market in mind, the sort that sold counterfeit handbags and watches. Importers of all kinds were fans of these counterfeit products, and Stanley smiled knowingly when they said it was what they were looking for. The government was actually complicit in the maintenance of these counterfeit markets, and officials knew that while some importers complained about piracy in general, foreign buyers liked to run out and purchase such products themselves. Like big banquets and foot massages, shopping for knockoffs was a standard stop on any manufacturing trip through China. Stanley walked us back to the hotel from the shopping trip, and with the business relationship all sewn up, I had a final question for him. There was something about him that made me think he might not actually be from mainland China. His act was too polished, his English too fluent, and he said that he had been flying to the United States before China had really opened up in any meaningful way. I wanted to know whether he was actually from Taiwan, but the issue was too sensitive for a direct approach. "Where did you go to school?" I asked, in as casual a manner as possible. "You don't know the place," he said. "It's about 180 kilometers from here." The city of Taipei was actually just so far away. I next asked whether he thought that Taiwan was a part of China. It was a big question. In mainland China, over 99.9% of the population felt that it was, but attitudes in Taiwan were more divided, and there was debate on the matter. Stanley hesitated and said, "Most people would say that it is." A comment like that was considered blasphemous to people in mainland China, and it was as close to an admission as I would get. South China was full of entrepreneurs from Taiwan. Though considered Chinese, the locals resented them. The workers accused factory bosses from Taiwan of being xiaoqi, cheapskates, for paying like a local company, if not worse. Taiwanese were seen as carpetbaggers, and some felt that they took away opportunities that should have gone to mainland Chinese firms. Taiwanese business owners were occasionally even taken hostage and held for ransom. If Stanley was from Taiwan, the threat of kidnapping was reason enough to keep quiet about his place of origin. On the business side of things, there was another possible explanation for the hidden identity. Seasoned importers did not like to work with Taiwanese firms because they had a reputation for charging more than firms owned by mainland Chinese. One reason that Taiwanese firms charged more for their products made in mainland China was that their operating costs and cost of capital were often higher. While it looked like the trip might have been considered a failure for the group, they had, after all, found only the most obvious supplier, one that also made goods for the competition. Everyone from Classic Metal was satisfied. They had no option, really, but they chose to see the trip as their good fortune. After the group returned to the United States, we stayed in touch by email. I submitted my invoice, which included receipts for reimbursement, but payment never came. Tiring of delays, I called the company, but no one answered the phone. There was only a voice recording where there had once been a receptionist to answer calls. The company had gone bankrupt. I caught up with John, who insisted that he himself did not know that it was coming. The head of the company surely must have, though. The CEO had not only stiffed his workers on their payroll, he had absconded with their retirement fund as well. Coming to China just months before declaring bankruptcy made their visit seem strange. Just like that, a $50 million company was out of business. It occurred to me that they might have made it if they had only come to China earlier, like their competitors had. There were many Americans who thought taking business overseas destroyed jobs in the United States. This was one case in which coming to China at the right time might have actually saved a few.